Merhaba ve hoş geldiniz. Hello and welcome to Talking Round North Cyprus. I'm Sarah Palmer and this is a podcast where we chat about all things related to the wonderful country, including conversations with people from all walks of life that have some sort of connection with the TRNC. In a short while, we're going to be hearing from author Malcolm Hollydrake, who lived in the island back in the 1980s, has written a really good book set there. But right now, we'll hear from my co-host and my very good friend, Roger Barra. So, Rog, normally you live close to Iskele near Boaz, but you're still on your holidays out west. Are you having a good time?
Yeah, we had a great time. It's as we don't really do much travelling away for the TRNC anymore. We've sort of rented a holiday home in Lapta. And of course, the Lapta area and the Iskele area are completely different. It is so. It's like going almost to another country. There's no high rise out here in Alsanshak area, Lapta. Even the people seem a little bit different. They seem more chatty. And, you know, you'll just be talking to any anonymous person who you've never met in the supermarket and you carry on chatting for ages. So we really enjoy our time here. Lots of friends over here and lots of parties to go to. So what's not to like?
I was going to say, it sounds like you're living the dream. And I know you've said that before. So I'm really glad that it's all going well. That's lovely. So let's get on to a little bit of business. Now, there's been some angst, hasn't there, among British expats recently about their UK bank accounts. So can you enlighten us?
Yeah, the headline on last week's Cyprus Today, the English language newspaper, says don't bank on them. And it's all about Brits living in the TRNC. They've been getting letters, well, those that get here to the TRNC, from their banks in the UK telling them that their accounts will be closed. And it's all to do with not having a UK address. And some banks are closing accounts for those that are not domiciled in the UK. Now, of course, you can still have an address. The paper said they've learned that some account holders of NatWest and Santander UK have been informed they can no longer keep their accounts. Now, they don't think it's anything to do with being a resident of the TRNC. It's just a general pattern that UK banks cut back on services they provide to overseas customers. I mean, the banks will say it's aimed at tackling fraud and money laundering, but we all know it's probably just to save money.
Yeah, isn't that a shame? And then they're offering no sort of, you know, not compensation, but no sort of help. So I guess people have to change banks, do they? If, you know, if it's just those two that are doing it. But, you know, often when banks do that, other banks follow suit, don't they? Because they think, oh, yeah, that's a good idea.
It is annoying because, you know, many expats continue to maintain UK bank accounts for things like, you know, receiving their state pension, maybe rental income or national savings and investment products. So it's going to be very inconvenient. Now, it's not all banks. And the banks are obliged to give you notice. But of course, you know what the postal system is like here. People, you know, might one day wake up having been sent something that they've not received from the bank and suddenly realize you've got no UK bank account.
Yeah.
So
how
that's all going to work, I have no idea. But it's not great news, is it?
No, not at all. And especially if you travel back to the UK, sometimes you then, you know, you revert, don't you, to your UK bank account because it's just easier. So, well, we'll follow that and see what's happening there. And obviously, if you're listening to this and it's happened to you and you've resolved it in some way, then please do get in touch. We'll tell you how to do that at the end of our little chat. Also, there's been some meetings recently between movers and shakers. Anything particularly relevant that we should know about?
Well, one of the things is quite interesting in that five UK cross-party politicians have come to the TRNC on a fact-finding mission. Now, this was arranged by an organisation called Freedom and Fairness for Northern Cyprus Campaign UK. So it's quite a historic visit, and they've met also representatives of the British Residents Society. So they've been told, you know, black and white, just how difficult it can be. You know, the issue of hair care, health care, the lack of social care and end of life care for expats, and the general isolation that you feel when you're a resident of the TRNC. So, you know, the trip's not going to change, of course, how the TRNC is viewed by the UK government. But It's got to be a good thing that you've got five people from all sorts of parties, you know, that are all parliamentarians that are seeing firsthand exactly what it's like. Of course, they've met the movers and shakers as well from the government here. So it won't change anything short term, but I don't see it being anything other than a good idea. And if you want to read more about it, you can go on to cyprusscene.com, who have got a full report of who was met and who the people involved were. cyprusscene.com.
Yeah, and I think, because I don't know the names of the MPs off the top of my head, I did see the an article, but there are a lot of Turkish Cypriots who live in areas of London, and they will have MPs. So those MPs know that Turkish Cypriots are in their constituency. So I'm guessing that, you know, their eyes are open to the fact that the TRNC does exist.
And the BRS letter writing lobbying campaign, we've been told not to underestimate that. You know, members and non-members send lobbying letters to their local MP, or if you live here, the UK's Foreign Office. Word, it seems to be getting around, and that can only be a good thing.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Yes, knowledge and acknowledgement is a good thing as well. Yes. And wasn't President Tatar, hasn't he been busy shaking hands?
Yes, this isn't quite so positive, I don't think. But yeah, President Tatar's received a special representative of the UN Secretary General in Cyprus and the head of the UN Peacekeeping force. That's a guy called Colin Stewart. But you know, all the president has said is our position is clear. We don't have the necessary conditions to start formal negotiations once again with the Greek side. Tatar said we've put forward our new policy 2 years ago at the Geneva meetings, and this new policy is being pursued with the full support of Turkey. We have re-emphasized today, said the president, that official negotiations can commence only in the case that we accept sovereign equality and equal international status of the Turkish Cypriot people. And as we know, Sarah, that ain't going to happen.
Worth a try. Worth a try. You can't fault him for trying, it has to be said. But something sort of positive, and this will be interesting to see if we can actually, quote, get it off the ground. Isn't there a new Turkish Cypriot airline? I think it's today, the 15th of March, as we're recording this. Isn't that about to launch?
Oh, yes, it is. There's been a sort of a big celebration at the new terminal building at Ercan Airport, which isn't open yet. And I still don't know. We still don't know when it's going to open. But yeah, Fly Kypris Airlines, or Fly KHY, is the new airline. They have an Airbus A320 aircraft, and it's due to make its first scheduled flight from Istanbul to Ercan in the middle of April with 174 passengers. Now, at first, the idea is this new airline will organize two reciprocal flights to Istanbul and one reciprocal daily flight to Ankara and Izmir. And there are plans for charter flights from Erbil, Tehran, Pristina, Amman, and Baku as of May. But it all seems a bit strange that suddenly these flights direct from other countries can come in, or maybe they will be going via Istanbul, via Turkey. We don't know. It's got to be a good thing if this happens. But it does worry me that if it's cheaper, which is the whole point, to get to Istanbul with this new airline, if you're going to London or Manchester, you know, anywhere, you've then got to change planes in Istanbul. And of course, the new airline only has to get you to Istanbul. It's not obliged to get you. So if there's a delay and you miss your ongoing flight, there's nothing you can do about it. Whereas if you go Turkish Airlines or Pegasus and get flights via Turkey to London, they are obliged to get you to your destination. So even if your first flight is delayed, they have to put you on a subsequent flight and get you there. So, but you've got to start somewhere, I suppose. So it's encouraging in that respect.
Yes, yes, absolutely. And also it's worth checking, isn't it? Because there are two airports in Istanbul and they're quite a long way away from each other. And the Sabiha Gökçe one, I probably pronounce that completely differently than it should be, but the one in the south is like the sort of regional airport. And then you have to get a coach and get across and get to the main airport as well. So it's worth looking and making sure, you know, you've got time to get an international flight if that's what you're doing.
Yeah, but Sabiha Gökçen Airport is still an international airport, although it does deal with a load of...
Right.
Because the Stansted flights go, Pegasus Stansted flights go via there. But you're right, they're not close, those airports. It will take you, even not in rush hour, about 3 hours. You've got to cross the Bosphorus. It's a really slow journey. And I know lots of people that have come unstuck, maybe where a travel agent has booked their flight and got it wrong.
Yeah.
And suddenly you've got 2 hours for your connecting flight, but you've got to get 3 hours across Istanbul in a bus or a taxi. And that's there is when you realise just how big Istanbul is. It is massive. Yeah. It's got to be one of the biggest cities in the world. I know the population now is supposed to be between 18, 19 million. It is enormous.
Yeah. Fingers crossed, everything's positive. So we'll wait to see, A, if the airport opens or the new lounge opens, and where we get with the flights. Lovely. Okay, well, let's crack on then with our special guest today. He is the author of the Harrogate Crime series, which features DCI Bennett. And his name is Malcolm Hollydrake. He's also written the Merseyside Crime series. But I was particularly interested in his first novel, Bridging the Gulf, that's partly set in North Cyprus. So I was keen to know Malcolm's connection with the TRNC, and I was delighted that he agreed to chat to us. And I started by asking him if it was right that he was born in a library.
Yes, so I was, strangely enough, in Bradford in 1953. My grandparents had what was called a penny library then, and my parents had moved in while they were waiting to find a house. And that's where I was born. So I used to tell people I was born between criminal fiction and psychology in the aisles, but that's not necessarily true. I was born in the flat below. But it's something that always stuck with me. Yeah, we moved about 500 yards up the road to West Street. And strangely enough, that's where I set my first ever book.
Oh, right. So do you think then it was sort of a little bit in your DNA? I mean, obviously your grandparents had a library. I mean, I know you were born in a library, but, you know, were you always into books and writing and reading?
Exactly the opposite. Mm. Completely the opposite. I enjoyed books as a child, but I wasn't the bookworm that many children are. I've always enjoyed nonfiction, strangely enough, and still do. And now I will not read a crime novel because it might just influence the way that one of my books will go. Enjoy the printed word, but I've always enjoyed writing for the sake of children, because being a teacher for 32 years, I used to write an awful lot of end of day stories for them. And I used to enjoy telling them rather than reading them. So when I was a head teacher, I used to take all the children into the hall at the end of Friday afternoon and tell them all to give teachers non-contact time. So you have to be fairly good, believe you me, to keep from 5-year-olds to 11-year-olds fully occupied for sort of 45 minutes.
Yeah.
And so I did an awful lot of that. I suppose really the first one was Bridging the Gulf, and it was all through not living in Northern Cyprus that came about.
Yes, I was going to say, what took you from North Yorkshire to North Cyprus?
We'd been working in Cairo. I was a senior teacher of 1,000 pupils school in Cairo. We didn't rent the house out in the UK. We decided that we would just close it down. But we foolishly just took a local currency salary, which was great until the Egyptian pound started to slip considerably. There was a coup, which meant that quite a few people were killed whilst we were there. We were transferring money on the black market to get it back into the UK, which was a definite no-no. And in the end, we decided that enough was enough. And my brother-in-law was a policeman in London, and he was a friend with a gentleman called Adnan, who had a Turkish restaurant. And he said, well, there's jobs going in Northern Cyprus. And being totally ignorant of Northern Cyprus, you think, well, sounds lovely, Cyprus, doesn't it? So we went over there, and my wife was appointed as an English teacher at Turk Marif College in Famagusta. But there was a very strange point, because as we went in, we flew into Gecikkale. We were supposed to be met by the education department to be taken to a hotel, and they would then decide which school. But waiting at the airport was Adnan's brother and his wife, who didn't have a word of English, and we had no Turkish at the time. And they said, you're coming with us. And you think, two strange people have just met us at a strange airport, and we're going to get in their car and we're going to drive. So we got in and away we went for about 5 months until we found the apartment that we needed. Because Turkish Cyprus in 1986 was a very, very different, I'm sure you know, it was a very different place than what it is now. And it was just a great adventure. So Debbie was thrown into teaching at Turk Marif College. I decided to take a year completely away from working and concentrate on artwork, by which time I was invited to read the news in Nicosia in English. And I thought, no, I'll pass on that. Thank you very much. And then I was asked if I wanted to do a teaching job. And very cleverly, we decided on this occasion that we would take half English sterling and half local currency, which made a big difference. So I said, yes, I will work, I'll teach for the same contract. Yes, yes, we'll do the same contract. So I took a dolmush all the way up to, which it was a long journey in 86 to Lefkoşa. Got there and then they said, no, it's just local currency. So I came all the way back. We got like that. So we decided, no, that's what we do. But we had some really good times there.
I bet. So have you been back since? I mean, that was, you said, 85.
Yes, 85. We lost. We came away in 88 and we didn't go back until the mid-90s. And then we went to the Hideaway just outside Kyrenia, because we very rarely went to Kyrenia whilst we were living in Famagusta. We used to go once a month to the Dragon because it had a library. And we used to go for liver and onions and to change the books and then come back. And I think it was in 1987 we decided, because you couldn't buy a car other than a Turkish left-hand drive vehicle, we drove our car from England over Bulgaria, Istanbul, Ankara, down to Mersin and across, which was a nice adventure in itself. And then we would drive over to the Dragon and we'd change our books and then back. But we very rarely stayed in Ghana. When we went to the Hideaway, I used to run an awful lot. So I used to run from the Hideaway up the hill to Kami and look at the village. I just think that's a lovely little village up here. We decided one day we'd sit down, well, wouldn't it be nice to have a house back in Cyprus? So we bought a house in Kami in, I think, 99. Had, I think, 7 lovely years up there.
Amazing.
And we would have stayed. I was trying to get hold of a gallery. There was opposite our house, there was an empty space. And I was making quite a bit of leaded windows, stained glass windows at that time. And I'd made quite a few for people in Cyprus and take them over. I'd made them in Cairo and I couldn't get this room because they wanted it to be a coffee shop for some reason.
Somebody's brother probably wanted it.
And so anyway, so it went to a Turkish Cypriot in the end, which was fine. That's fine. But it meant that I came away. And had I not done that, I don't think I've done any writing whatsoever. So it's all fate, isn't it?
Yes, it is. Isn't that interesting? Yeah. So then you came back and then you started. Is that when you started your the Harrogate crime series?
I wrote the Bridge in the Gulf first.
Oh, right. OK.
And that was my first novel. And then I won a short story competition from the Lancashire Magazine. Winning the prize for a Yorkshireman is always nice, particularly if it's cash. And it wasn't that was the... I got a breakdown of my writing by the judging panel. And I thought, maybe my writing isn't that bad, you know. And I was looking for a place to set a crime series. I knew Harrogate so well because I was at college in Ripon. I lived in Bradford. We used to travel through. My grandfather was born in Ramsgill. So I thought, well, that would be nice. And then I read in the Telegraph that it was the happiest place in the UK to live at the time. So I thought, okay, I'll introduce a little bit of crime. So that's how it started. It's now the fourth happiest place in the UK to live, so I'm winning.
And is that down to you?
I don't know. I'm saying no.
Slowly sliding down the scale, thanks to your series. So tell us about Bridging the Gulf. And obviously you had that connection with Famagusta. So why that sort of PTSD, the war inference as well?
Well, I was fascinated by the PTSD and how it was being ignored totally, really. Even for a layman like me, I could see that there was a possibility that all the drugs had been injected with, the amount of burning oil and all of those things could have a marked effect on anybody, particularly somebody with a low immune system. And I then heard that if you went to Northern Cyprus, you couldn't be extradited anywhere because they didn't have a procedure with the UK. And You knew yourself. Nazl Nadir popped in, didn't he, and stayed and things. So I thought, well, that's an interesting connection. And how would you fight if you were a lone voice? How would you get a government? And we see it. We've seen it with COVID, really, in a way. How would you get them to listen to genuine concerns from people who have put their life on the line for a government? And I just thought, well, all of the motorway bridges throughout the UK are just so vulnerable. You know yourself when there's an accident on the motorway, how it just says, well, there's an hour, 2 hours delay. So I thought, well, I live near a motorway bridge. And I just thought, well, if that stopped running, there's nowhere we can go. So imagine setting up 57 timed, ready to explode bombs, and then just start blackmailing one at a time and let some go. Strangely enough, about 4 years after I'd written this, all the motorway bridges were reinforced throughout the UK. Now, I know it's nothing to do with this book, but it was to do with the weight of certain continental wagons coming in. But I did, I just thought, well, it's a marvellous way of stopping, of grinding a country to a halt. Yeah. Snow does it beautifully sometimes in winter, doesn't it? Yeah. So a few bombs. But finding the information was the hardest part. You ever trying to find out how much Semtex you'd need to blow up a motorway bridge?
I haven't actually. No, that's not on my Google search, I have to say.
I'm glad you haven't. Well, it's very, very hard, believe you me. Right. And I was always waiting for the knock at the door. Search history was tremendous at that time. But it was a friend who came to me, and I was pondering this. And he said, what's the matter? And they said, well, I'm trying to find out how much Semtex used to blow up Gatherth Bridge. He said, why? I said, well, you need to have facts. You need to have it. He said, no. You're right, you used just enough. And it was like a light bulb moment coming on. You know what, he's right. So it's actually influenced the way that I write quite a few things now. You can't find the exact amount, you use just enough.
Oh, right, yeah, because you're not writing a manual on how to blow up a bridge.
No,
day, right. Are you?
Well, it was, I hope not.
Yeah, I mean, it's lovely to read a book where you're familiar with the place. That's what's so nice, you know.
A lot of people, like the Harrogate series because of that, and my Merseyside series. I get comments again. Oh, it's lovely to know. I've been down that road so often, and now I see it in a very different light. In fact, people go over Gatherth Bridge, and they make a bomb noise, make an explosion noise as they go over it because it's stuck in their mind for so long, or Pennine Way or the bridge. And it's nice that you might have that degree of influence over somebody's pleasure, in a way.
Yeah.
Reading pleasure.
Yes.
And Northern Cyprus is such a wonderful place to write about. I mean, the castles alone are just stunning. And the little hidden places. Yeah. And they're still there. I mean, they were there in abundance when I was, because it was all fields when I was a lad there. I mean, you couldn't buy a loaf of bread properly in 1886. We have to go to Naffy at Ayas Nicolaias, really, up to the Ionic Naffy.
When was the last time you were there then?
Oh, it's a few years now.
Yeah.
About four years. We saw, because the writing, they were starting to build so much.
Yeah, still.
But they didn't build, they just put some things halfway up and then left it. And we just understood. We thought we'd had the best. We thought we'd seen North Cyprus at its best. And a lot of the people we knew in the village were leaving. They were getting to a certain age and they had to go. And believe you me, Calmy had its characters. It really did. We used to have a summer party in the garden. And we were lucky because we had a stream that ran through the garden all the year round. So we used to put all the beer bottles and the wine in the stream to keep it cool. The trouble is, all the labels used to float off in the night, so it was a lucky dip what you actually picked out then. But we had a live band, and we had about 100 people came, and it was fantastic. It was our treat to ourselves every year to have, and people crawled home. It was just lovely. It was a lovely, lovely event. So safe, so secure.
Yes, it still is in a way. I mean, a lot of building. I'm over the sort of Famagusta way, Iskele and Boaz, and that's really sort of, you know, just shooting up at the moment. And in a way, it brings prosperity into the area, but it does seem to be losing a little bit of the charm.
Yes. There was an innocence about Northern Cyprus. Mm. I think there was a vulnerability too. And I think that was brought about, but it was always the underdog, I think. And I can remember in the 80s when you used to go up to Park Hotel or to Salem's Bay, there was nothing. We once travelled up to the Panhandle on Christmas Day. We drove up and we stopped outside a what looked like a wooden air raid shelter. And it was a restaurant. And we said, is there fish available today? This was Christmas Day. He said, if there's fish, I will put a sign out when you come back. And we drove all the way up and all the way back. And I think we saw two cars in all of that journey. And there was a sign outside saying fish. So we went in and we had fish for Christmas lunch. And it was just special, so yeah. Special.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of people are trying to, you know, are sort of keeping it local where they can, which is nice. Yes. But there are a lot of developers and there's a lot of money to be made, I think, sadly. So, you know.
There always yeah. was. I can remember going to Essentepi from my house. It would take me an hour on that country road that went round the coast. And then they put the motorway in and it took 15 minutes. But sadly, they got rid of the old road because that's a wonderful tourist route for cyclists or for... But it was just cut completely in pieces. Mm. And it was progress. Just that lack of vision beforehand was a bit sad, really.
Yeah, yeah. So what are you working on at the moment?
I've just finished book 13 for the Harrogate series. Called Trap Secrets. That's at the proofread at the moment. I am contracted with Holbeck Books to write one more for the Merseyside, which I'll be starting soon. And then I'd like to write a standalone again. I'm loving it. I'm getting a bit too old for it, but I'm loving it.
Oh, rubbish, rubbish. So I'm always fascinated how writers write. I mean, are you disciplined? Do you get up and you're like, right, here we go? Or do you sort of waft about until an idea comes to you? How does it work for you?
Well, I have this smoking jacket that I put on, first of all. I never plan a book. I have an idea. I start with an idea. And I will sit down and I will write 1,000 words a day, which will mean I will read then the previous 1,000 and do some adjustments to that and then carry on. And then as the book develops, I will then read every pad of 4 or 5. I will read the whole thing, make sure it's going in balance. And I will sometimes not know the ending until I'm 2/3 through the book writing. Mm. But I'm a pantser. They're called pantsers. There are planners and pantsers. And I just sit down and write.
Right.
And if I can do 1,000 a day, I'm happy. And even if I'm on holiday, I will write. It just keeps you in the swing. I'm having a break now, obviously, because I'm waiting for this to come back. Because it's very hard, so writing two series, because you have, you try to make them very different, but you have two sets of different detectives. So I wrote the book 12 and book 13 together, and then I will write the next one for the Merseyside and go with that. Mm. And I have a very understanding publisher who says, well, I said, I'd like to write 13 and then come to you. And they said, yeah, okay. Because they were working on the audiobooks for the second book, same for the Merseyside.
Right.
So it's about give and take, and that's a good thing about a nice publisher. They will understand. Because today you should be getting books out fairly regularly to keep the read-through of your other books going.
Sure, sure.
But that depends whether you're trying to make a full-time living out of it, and that's not the name of the game for me. I'm enjoying the writing process, and it's nice that they do get accolade and they do get liked. And people say, when's the next one out? There's nothing nicer than when you get pestered. I'm waiting for 13. Please get it there. But realistically, it's just pleasant to sit down and write.
Yeah. Does it help having those characters already sort of formed, if you like?
Very much.
To help with the storyline and, you know, because people already know them. If necessary.
Yes, yeah. And I've been amazed how many people are really following the characters as much as the storyline itself. They want to know where Cyril's going, what's he been doing, what's David doing, how's his new baby doing. And that's rather nice because these people don't really exist, of course, but they do, as far as I'm concerned, they're part of our family. It's lovely to develop, and I've actually had to kill one member of the team off, which was very, very hard, because I thought I was coming towards the end of that writing career, in a way. And then I got another boost by they wanted more books. So Debbie said to me, my wife said, if you kill off the person you're going to kill off, your series is dead. So I thought, yeah, she's right, you know. So I killed another one of these days.
The power.
That power of it, huh?
Didn't tie them to a branch and blow it up, did you? No.
No, 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 no. In fact, it was far worse than that,
Oh,
strangely enough.
goodness. Okay. I won't
No,
ask. So, do you think you'll go back to North Cyprus at any point? Would you be interested in seeing what it's like? And
yeah, we've got some lovely friends there. When we lived down in Ayuga, Tongas, the couple we were to stay with, they're still there now. They've got this lovely house. All their kids have grown up that we know, and they've got kids themselves. So yes, we'll be going back to see them, and the Sanners, who we used to live opposite, we'll go and see them. People in the village we know. The car rental, when they first started off, I remember. I'm sure they're a massive concern now, popping at
probably.
the hideaway. Yeah, all
Yeah.
the old haunts.
Yeah.
Patek's Coffee House in Famagusta, we used to always love going.
Oh, that's amazing. That hasn't changed at all, to be honest. That's still the same.
Is it still the same?
Still got the budgerigars in
Oh,
the out the
fantastic.
front, and the turtles or whatever they are in the pond in the middle. Oh.
Oh, has it
Yeah.
still got the copper canopy in the inside? They
Yes.
had a, have
Yes.
they? I remember them
Yes.
building that.
Oh,
And we were
really?
sitting in having coffee, and they're in there knocking this thing, and it didn't actually fit. So they were bashing it to fit. Oh, it was lovely. It
They
was one
made
of
it
those.
fit.
They made it fit. And you used to get your coffee, didn't you? Which was a hot milk, and they used to float the granules of coffee.
So that was Malcolm Holly-Drake reminiscing about how things were back in the 1980s. Some things don't change. Some things are still as in the 1980s. But do get hold of the book if you can. It's called Bridging the Gulf. It's a really good thriller. It really is. And as I say, it's really nice to sort of read about places that you know. I know some things have changed, but do get hold of that if you can. So thank you very much indeed to Malcolm for having a chat with me.
Yeah, very interesting chap. And I haven't read his, the novels he writes are just the type of books that I read in retirement. Basic procedurals, you know, police procedurals, thrillers. And so I've got a lot of catching up to do to read the Harrogate crime series to start with.
On your list. Well, if you want to break into my apartment, Roger, Bridging the Gulf is in my bookcase there back in Famagusta. So it's there to read for anybody that goes there.
Okay, I'll have to break in, but you don't mind.
No, that's
But
fine. Just leave the wine.
the idea that you leave any wine in your fridge after your holiday, come on.
Yeah, just take the book. Take the book. So, thanks ever so much for listening to our podcast. You can always get in touch with us. We're on Facebook and Twitter. Just look for Talking Round North Cyprus. We have an email address as well, trnc.podcast@gmail.com. If there's anything we've talked about that you'd like to get involved in, or you've got a story about why you're in North Cyprus and you'd like to chat to us, we'd absolutely love to hear from you. I'm Sarah Palmer.
And I'm Roger Barr. I hope to talk to you again very, very shortly.